Hi, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we invite a poet to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss. Then, they read a poem of their own that's been published in the magazine. Today, my guest is Evie Shockley, the author of 6 poetry collections and the Zora Neale Hurston Distinguished Professor of English at Rutgers University. Her honors include the 2023 Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America, a Landon Literary Award, the Stephen Henderson Award, and twice the Hurston Wright Legacy Award in Poetry. Evie, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Kevin.
So the first poem you've selected to read is Hattie McDaniel Arrives at the Coconut Grove by Rita Dove. What drew you to this particular poem while you were looking through our archive?
Wow. Many things. I mean, the first of which is just that I'm a huge fan of Rita Dove's and have been for a long time. I always loved her work, but there's like a personal connection now because my sister and her family live in Akron, where she grew up. And so I think I think of her as a kind of patron saint of my nieces. but seriously, the poem itself is just one that I have loved since the first time I saw it and heard her read it. It's got, I think, some of the classic Rita Dove characteristics, this elegance and poise and dash, and it just draws you in. It's beautiful language and a sort of a lovely take on histories that are not entirely lovely, right?
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Let's listen to the poem. This is Evie Shockley reading Hattie McDaniel Arrives at the Coconut Grove by Rita Dove.
Hattie McDaniel arrives at the coconut grove, late, in aqua and ermine, gardenias scaling her left sleeve in a spasm of scent, her gloves white, her smile chastened, purse giddy with stars and rhinestones clipped to her brilliantined hair, on her free arm that fine Negro, Mr. Wonderful Smith. It's the day that isn't, February 29th, at the end of the shortest month of the year, and the shittiest, too, everywhere except Hollywood, California, where the maid can wear mink and still be a maid, bobbing her bandaged head and cursing the white folks under her breath as she smiles and shoos their silly daughters in from the night dew. What can she be thinking of, striding into the ballroom where no blackface has ever showed itself, except above a serving tray? Hi-hat Hattie, Mama Mac, her haughtiness, the little lady from Showboat whose name Bing forgot, Beulah and Bertha and Melina and Carrie and Violet and Cynthia and Fidelia, one half of the dark Barrymores. Dear Mammy, we can't help but hug you, crawl into your generous lap, tease you with arch innuendo, so we can feel that much more wicked and youthful and sleek. But oh, what we forgot! The four husbands, the phantom pregnancy, your famous parties, your celebrated icebox cake. You giggle above the red petticoats rustle, black girl and white girl walking hand in hand down the railroad tracks in Kansas City, 6 years old. The man who advised you, now that you were famous, to begin eliminating your more common acquaintances, and your reply, catching him square in the eye, "That's a good idea. I'll start right now by eliminating you." Is she or isn't she? 3 million dishes, a truckload of aprons and head rags later, and here you are, poised between husbands and factions, no corset wide enough to hold you in, your huge face a dark moon split by that spontaneous smile, your trademark, your curse. No matter, Hattie. It's a long, beautiful walk into that flower-smothered standing ovation. So go on and make them wait.
That was Hattie McDaniel Arrives at the Coconut Grove by Rita Dove, which was published in the May 10th, 2004 issue of The New Yorker, and again in the August 29th, 2022 archive issue. Well, what a wonderful reading of a wonderful poem. And we also have Mr. Wonderful Smith in the poem, among other figures. And I love that list in the middle. Showboat whose name break, Bing forgot, Beulah and Bertha and Melina and Carrie and Violet and Cynthia and Fidelia. One Lovely. Half of the Dark Barrymores. I mean, so good.
Lovely. I mean, it gives you a sense of all the women around Hattie McDaniel, right?
That's right. Who she both embodied and, you know, made her own, but also was limited to in some way. And I think Dove really captures that complexity that she both brought to those roles and was faced with. She's one of my favorites from that time. And, you know, I really think that her and Louise Beavers, I mean, to me, these are people who knew how to do a lot of complicated things with limited roles.
Exactly.
And brought humanity to inhumane conditions.
Exactly. It's a delicate balancing act, this kind of, you know, how do you make a living? What are you willing to take in order to sort of wedge the door open just a little bit more? I think about other characters, male characters from that period, Step and Fetch It, for example, who I think maybe are not even given as much grace as we give Hattie McDaniel and Louise Beavers, like you said, for kind of doing what they felt like they had to do. Where would we be if they hadn't done these roles? It's not clear. But they brought their sense of self. They brought more to the characters than was written into the scripts.
Sure, sure. I love this moment where she says, it's the day that isn't. February 29th, at the end of the shortest month of the year, and the shittiest, too, everywhere, except Hollywood, California. A little bit of humor, a little bit of naughtiness even, you know, a little cursing, which we don't necessarily expect in this kind of rhinestone, brilliantine world. And I think there's something about that that Dove also captures in one of her most famous lines, if you can't be free, be a mystery, about Billie Holiday. And here, she's visiting something, I think, a little like that, but a little different. It's its own poem. And there's something about that arrival. You know, she makes it into a different kind of arrival. She's arrived.
She's arrived.
How do you take that? And how do you feel like it comes up, poetically speaking?
I mean, just thinking about the lines you read there, the shortest month of the year and the shittiest, too. I mean, you hear her not just making jokes, but also making rhymes. And all of it wrapped up in this month that we are tied to, Black History Month, where we are granted the opportunity to kind of focus in on these things. I would say the poem is an example of how that history spills over the edges all the time. She arrives, and it can only be, you know, a few minutes, this passage, but we get so much time passing within the time of her walk. This arrival has been a long time coming, just in the sense of the Oscars, and there's a long future still ahead of this walk to something, well, I mean, something that we still haven't achieved, a kind of a real equity or full representation in the movies. But she lets McDaniel move through that moment larger than life as she was in life, so to speak. And the poem, with all of its beautiful details, is also larger than life. And yet there's this sense of containment. The corset that barely can contain her, the short month that can barely contain this history.
Yeah.
I like to think of the poem as kind of bookended between rhymes. The title is the first line of the poem, but the first word of the body proper is late, and it ends with wait, and in between is just everything.
Yeah. And I think that distance, it's a long, beautiful walk. And the poem itself has that. It has a kind of promenading quality. It isn't scared to take a moment to describe a moment, but also right. to sort of invoke and move. A moment for me that is hearing you read it really stuck out is this moment where she says, as she smiles and shoos their silly daughters in from the night dew, dot, dot, dot. What can she be, break, thinking of? Whoa.
Oh
you know, what a beautiful line break. And then striding into the ballroom break where no black face has ever showed itself, break, except above a serving tray. And all those moments, it's unfolding for us, right? You know,
exactly.
She's striding. She's not supposed to be there, except, you know, it kind of almost falls through these different levels. And I think a good poem does that. And the enjambment, which is literally, as you know, throwing a leg over the line that turns, what can she be, break, thinking of, you know, she's literally enjambing herself into this setting. So there's this wonderful coalition that she's created in these lines.
And you just see how virtuosic Dove is, just how in control of the language. That line break probably sold me on the poem before I got any farther. Just what can she be? And to leave you to sit with that thought for as long as your brain can come up with answers, right? What
mm-hmm.
can she be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I also really, I find myself intrigued by the line break that's also a stanza break at the end of the next stanza that I don't know where to start to kind of bring us into it, but this is, dear mammy, we can't help. And this is without commas, without punctuation. Dear mammy, we can't help but hug you, crawl into your generous lap, tease you with arch innuendo so we can feel that much more wicked and youthful and sleek. But oh, what? Like all of that, there are, I guess, five lines, but no punctuation. You're just kind of propelled through the poem. And then that stanza break, but oh, what we forgot. She gets us sort of revved up and moving and sort of rolling almost downhill. And then we pull out of that mammy figure that is giving, say, viewers a sense of themselves as being everything that she is not, right? Or everything that we think she is not. And she pulls us up short and then sends us into a stanza that gives us not who she appeared to be on camera, but who she was in her own life, the four husbands, the phantom pregnancy, and so forth.
Well, and your celebrated icebox cake, I want a piece of that. I think you absolutely nailed it in terms of this moment, because that comes after the Dear Mammy part, comes after this catalog, which starts earlier than we mentioned. Hi-Hat, Hattie, Mama Mac, her haughtiness. Those alliterations are so wonderful.
So much
there.
Fun to read.
And, you know, it has this kind of, you know, naming is so important, period. But in Black culture, it's everything in many ways. People are renamed, nicknamed, all these things. But then, Dear Mammy, we. And I think that unnamed we is just as important there. And reading it over, it sort of switches from this kind of description, let's call it a portrait of her, mm-hmm. to this we. And suddenly we're part of the poem. We've been there all along, but suddenly we're named. And I think it also makes us, as you say, aware that we've forgotten something, you know? And even if you think you know, she's mm-hmm. reminding us. And, you know, that's the most interesting, like, three-line biography, the four husbands, the phantom pregnancy, your famous parties, your celebrated icebox cake. I mean, those sounds are great. Your
yes.
celebrated icebox cake. So we have that kind of shorthand almost that is more hand in a way than what was before, because, mm-hmm. you know, those are novels, each one of those little phrases. And what we've gotten before is her haughtiness, her exterior, let's call it.
Yeah.
But I think it's just as important that she brings us into this interior with our wishes. And suddenly we're addressing the you, which mm-hmm. continues throughout the poem. She's no longer she's you. And that shift is so subtle, but so necessary and so powerful till the end.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, the moment of address, I mean, artist to artist, you might say. Yeah,
it is
beautiful. And it ends on the pronoun you, which is not McDaniel, but anyone who dared presume that they knew more about what she needed to do than she did.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. I'll start right now by eliminating you. We all wish we had that comeback. You know, that's one of those things you remember on the staircase leaving the party to be able to, in the moment, like, bring it to the fore. Wow. And then is she or isn't she?
I love that.
What do you make of that? It's so beautiful, but what do you make of that?
Well, I have this feeling that it's an echo from a cosmetics commercial or a hair dye commercial or something like that. Is she or isn't she dyeing her hair or something along those lines? It's just this from that generation, Dove's, my own, I guess, to a certain extent. If you remember that language, you know instantly we're talking about sort of women's mystique, the person behind the mask, how you project one image and only those who are really intimate with you know who you are.
Mm. I think it's Louise Beavers who had to go to training to speak, quote, dialect, you know. and stuff like that is just wild. You know, we're in a wild world of you got to go to training to learn what you're supposed to speak like and supposedly everyone speaks like. And, you know, the quote, like, I'd rather be playing a maid than being a maid, you know.
Yeah.
Though there's, you know, my family was a long line of domestic workers who sent people through college doing that.
Exactly.
So I think there's a lot of nobility that's being conjured. But then there's also this, no matter, Hattie. Like, it's like we're back in this moment. All that history, all that stuff, the pride, the conflicts, the what have you, doesn't matter. It's a long, beautiful walk into that flower-smothered standing ovation. So go on, you know.
Yes.
I love that break.
Another
and make
beautiful
them
line.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It sidelines so much of the ugliness, right?
Mm.
Just for a moment, and a moment that really intriguingly the poet asserts anyway that McDaniel is in control of the time of that moment, the duration of that moment. Go on and make them wait. I mean, when you start to talk about a Black person arriving late for anything, there's jokes behind that. There's a sort of a cultural embrace behind that. And obviously a stereotype that's viewed negatively by some, all sort of bound up in that. And this is the moment where this idea of, you know, CP time is is revealed to have a weaponized
right.
side.
Right. Again, if we don't know the full context, this is her arriving to eventually, ultimately get her Academy Award, the first Black person to receive an Oscar.
Exactly.
And for Gone with the Wind in 1939. But she's segregated away. You know, she can't be with the rest of the folks. And her speech, which I just remember almost the aftermath of, where she starts to cry. You know, this is the moment before that moment.
Right.
And I would write a poem about, like, her crying or something, or the movie. And actually, Dove, by picking the right occasion. And, you know, I don't think there's enough said about the occasion of a poem. Like, what's the moment? What makes someone write the poem, A? But also, what's that moment that it's encapsulating? It's so perfectly picked. And it tells us more than maybe even all these other anecdotes.
You know, I had not thought about that, Kevin. And you're right. I mean, just to decide the moment that that Dove wants in the frame of her camera lens, right? It's a beautiful moment. And more important than any kind of a revisiting, we get the gesture towards Gone with the Wind with the red petticoat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up watching that movie, and you see that just that line, and it takes you exactly to the moment in the film and all of the ambivalence that, as a Black person watching, you can't help but just sort of stew in a little bit. Mm-hmm. We're not lingering there. We're at the moment when perhaps she has the most power in her career, right?
Right, right. Well, I think that's beautifully put. I didn't grow up seeing Gone with the Wind and only saw it as a grown person at the Tara Theater Atlanta, Georgia. And the audience was not how you think. It was older black women, black men, and gay white men. It was like a really mixed, wonderful audience who have changed that movie's audience. And so I think there's a really interesting read also of this poem that this poem provides, that actually the star is not Scarlett O'Hara or, you know, anything like that. It's this moment. So I love that kind of reversal, inversion, rereading, revision, however you want to think of it. That's so simple, but also so beautifully put.
It's the ambivalence that I referred to earlier. I mean, you are confronted with some of the stereotypes that get written into the character, but there are ways in which, I mean, think about it. This is a moment when a mammy character, and you should just hear all the scare quotes around the word, right? But the mammy character, we get a glimpse of her having some kind of a sexuality, red petticoats. Mm. You know, like, there's so much going on. And it's not to say that Gone with the Wind was written for me or made for me. That's clearly not the case. But I think this poem invites us, among many other things that it does, it invites us to understand what black people have had to do, not only as actors with these kinds of limited roles, but then as audiences, to make these moments, if not these entire films, to find moments to take pleasure in. Cursing out the silly daughters. Like, who gets to do that? Well, she gets to do that.
Right,
right.
Really well said. Now, in our February 13th, 2023 issue, The New Yorker published your poem, The Blessings, which we'll hear you read in a moment. Is there anything you'd like to say about the poem first? Anything listeners should know going in?
I guess going in, I would just say that those of us who are sort of readers of black literature will find some Easter eggs in here. It's a little bit of a love letter to some of the figures that I admire and carry with me, even though that's not the thrust of this poem. This is a poem that I'll say I kind of intend it as an anthem, perhaps.
All right, well, let's hear it. Here's Evie Shockley reading her poem, The Blessings.
The Blessings. I gave mine away. Not all, but the greater portion, some would say. I gave away the ready claim to goodness, to purpose. I gave away Mary, Sarah, and Isis. I gave away necessity and invention. I gave away a whole holiday, but I kept Billy. I gave away the chance to try and fail to have it all. I gave away the one thing that makes some men pay. I gave away the pedestal, the bouquet. I gave away Nell Wright, but I kept Sula Peace. I gave away the fine-tooth comb, but kept the oyster knife. I gave away the first word the new mouth forms, the easiest to parlay across so many languages. Escaping the maw, I gave away the power to hold and be held in sway. But I kept Cho, Parton, Finney, Chapman, and Tomei. I gave away the Eve who left the garden that day, but kept the cool, green, shady, fruitless, fruitful stay. The evening that did not fall away.
That was The Blessings by Evie Shockley.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton. or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I love hearing all that rhyme, which you've embedded. You know, if you are hearing the poem for the first time, you make these connections. But when you see the poem, it kind of twists and turns, and you come across it. I think the place where it strikes me first, when you say, I gave away the pedestal, the bouquet, I gave away, you know, there's that lovely kind of repetition in the poem. And I love hearing the fine-tooth comb and the oyster knife. Now, you're the Zora Neale Hurston professor, so we need to explain to you, and I don't want to give away all of the Easter eggs, as you put it, but, you know, that Hurston quote, you know, I'm too busy sharpening my oyster knife. It's so wonderful, this idea of her not being worried, and this speaker in the anthem, as you put it, that's being part of it. I wonder how this poem came. Did it come as sort of entwined and rhymed, or is that something that the form you wanted to make it happen? Or, it, you know, poems have their own will sometimes, it can feel. But what? How did it come about?
You know, that's a really great question. At a certain point, I realized I had the potential to do, I think there's actually a technical term for this, where there's like a single rhyme that just repeats through a poem. But I didn't set out to do that. I think it may have been just the away and say, and you just, you kind of hear it yourself as you're writing, you're rereading the lines, trying to find the momentum. And once I knew I wanted to have the anaphora, the away kept calling other rhymes to it. So that wasn't a plan, but it became part of the engine that right. that kept me writing. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you have that kind of almost blues quality, yes but no, you know, mm-hmm. this but that, you know, and that kind of break, that caesura in the blues, or even the way that the blues has these two repeating rhyming couplet, or the same line, I should say, rhymed again, and then this third line that goes somewhere else, you know, often quite undercutting. It seems to me that's lurking behind in a powerful way.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I should have known that you would go to the blues, Kevin, for sure.
guilty as charged, I mean. But, you have here, we had mentioned Billie Holiday earlier. Mm-hmm. I gave away a whole holiday, and you read it so wonderfully, but I kept Billie, you know, this kind of like, hey, you know, because you got me on that one. I was like, oh, we're going to holidays now. But, oh, no, we're still in this realm of naming
yeah.
and renaming. You know, there's that roll call, shout outs, you know,
yes.
The most black thing on earth, you know, and here's my shout outs. And, you know, settle in, you're going to get a long list of roll call. And it's a way of honoring either the ancestors or the selves and the people who've gone before.
Yeah.
And how did you think about that? Did you think about it as a kind of naming in a black way?
Yes, for sure. I mean, the inspiration for this poem, I think I've told some people this, but maybe not you, came from listening to this podcast.
You have now you're just trying to get invited back.
No. I mean, anything to be in conversation with you, Kevin. But I remember vividly just where I was in my house listening to you. I think you were talking to Vijay, and it was about a Plath poem. And some gesture like she can call on Mary or, you know, when she's mm-hmm. writing about her own mother. And I thought, well, you know, I can call on Mary, but not in the sense of being a mother, since I'm not a mother. And it gave me this idea that I could call on certain other women who, like me, had chosen or had ended up, for whatever reason, not having kids, and that I could, you know, sort of pull all that power together into a single poem. You know, I'm thinking back to the reference to the blues and to the fact that some people have read this poem as a sad one. I think maybe people who have children. but this is not a poem that's sad about not having children. This is a poem that's sad about the ways that the society has made it difficult for people to make that choice. There's a kind of an edge of release in this poem from all the years that I had to argue, not least of all with my own mother, but, you know, having to kind of argue with people who, much less than my mother, shouldn't even feel a stake in whether I have children or not. And to kind of own that decision and, like you say, roll call other women who have made lovely lives in that choice.
Well, I love how you put that. It's so beautifully said. I love, too, how in the end of the poem, you bring your name in.
Mm. Yeah.
A version, I should say.
No.
How do you think about that? I mean, was that, like, just lurking there? Were you, like, thinking of a puzzle where you do that? You make a line at the end about your name. How did that happen? And forgive me if I'm overstepping by saying it's an echo of your name.
No.
But for me, that was just this brilliant... Another brilliant way of you digging into the double meanings of Eve, of course, the biblical Eve, but also this evening that did not fall away, which I never thought as a tragic thing. I thought it was like a triumphant one. So tell me about that.
You're right that writing Chazals over time and trying to find different ways of bringing my name into the final couplet has... you know, really attuned my ear for the moment when my name is embedded in words like evening. I'm also very, for the same reason, attuned to the fact that Eve means life for the reasons that we can imagine. So this idea that this is not a fall, a loss, but a celebration of the life of myself, my own life, rather than a new life, you know, so to speak. I like that that's available in there. And I like name-checking, you know, Margaret Cho, Dolly Parton, and especially Nikki Finney, Tracy Chapman. I love, you know, being able to kind of pull that circle together around me.
Well, and you're invoking myth and making it, too. And I think poems often do that because you're also talking about fictional figures like Sulla.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean myth in the sense we say things are fake. I mean myth in the generating original primary utterance. And I think that's so powerful.
Yeah.
Is the lowercase part of that? Tell me about that.
You know, I get asked questions about my lowercasing a lot.
I mean, I can understand why, but I want to hear your version of why.
No, understood. I mean, if you're just sort of being introduced to my work through this poem, then, you know, I can imagine that you would sit with those choices not to use capital letters for the I's, for the names, or anything else, and think about ways of reading that within the poem. But for me, it's an aesthetic gesture. I use this convention in all of my poetry. And in a sense, it's another connection that I like to draw between myself and poets like Lucille Clifton and Sonia Sanchez. I like that it gives your eye no particular place to look or to rest, that then you have a chance to look at each word and determine its importance in the sentence or in the line based on what it's doing. And it allows me to do things like surprise you with Billy when you've, you know,
right.
come across Holiday, right?
Right,
Holiday
right.
can play those double roles more easily. So those are some of the reasons why I do the lower casing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, June Jordan, who I knew a little bit, put it so wonderfully in terms of vertical rhythm, as she would
yes.
put it. And she talked about that. And I feel that, like she would have said that, I feel, about this poem. It has that downward motion that she said was one of the big inventions of the Black arts poets, some of whom you've name-checked just now.
Yes.
And I think that the lowercase I, for me, from Black Arts and Beyond, isn't like the humble I of modernism before. It's
definitely
really more
not
like a kind of spoken I.
Mm-hmm.
It's a confident self. It's many things. And I think you even see it in the beginning. It would be a really different poem if it was, because it has a number of I's in the mm-hmm. repetition. If it was capital, it would be a lot of sort of mask. And I feel like we're getting self.
Oh, I love the way you put that. I mean, I do think that it allows the emphasis in that anaphora to really lie on the idea of giving and away, right? And those are more important than the I. Or yeah. I want it to be an I that any woman who would like to slip into it can slip into it, right? But
right.
I want you to be thinking about the fact that this is not loss. This is gift.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Well, and giving away, the poem makes clear, isn't the same as loss.
Exactly.
But I love that contrast. And it just so happens that both the poems today, the title isn't quite the first line of this poem, but it certainly is referring to that. And so
yeah.
I love the way that those two poems, The Dove and yours, chime as well.
Oh, it feels like such an honor and a pleasure to have my work sort of in the same conversation with hers. She's just amazing.
Is this in a book yet? Is this in Suddenly We?
This is in Suddenly We. It was perhaps one of the last two or three poems that I added to the manuscript before finally Wesleyan snatched it out of my my fingers.
Are you a mad reviser? Are you thinking about the whole all the time? Or are you adding and, you know, just building where you build organically?
I mean, in terms of manuscripts, I am a big reviser. Maybe less so in terms of poems. My process is different from some of the diehard revisers. But with manuscripts, I'm always figuring out what it is until the very last second. And often some of the last poems that come in are really like clinchers. And I think it's partly because I don't write books. I write poems and find manuscripts over time. And so it really is, I think, a big discovery process for me. And yeah, I think I was learning how much a certain 360-degree view of Black womanhood was a subtext of Suddenly We, which is a book that's primarily about thinking in solidarity and coalition, thinking about how we form collectivities and wanting to make connections out of my own or anyone's own subject position across to things that we have in common with everyone, if nothing more than the fact that we live on this earth. So that was the main thrust of the manuscript. But
is that all? You're
just that.
I was just writing a poem about everyone on earth connected. just
tried.
A book. Just a book.
I really tried. I tried to write those poems again and again. But, you know, as one might say, looking back to that original Lucy in the cradle of civilization, I think that it became clear to me that I could do a lot of that work, or I was doing a lot of that work, very grounded in looking at Black women, myself and many, many others, what we've gone through and ways that we have found to make connections or to survive, just to get through things. So, this book, this poem felt like another dimension in that three-dimensionality that wasn't in the book before, and I'm really glad it made it in.
Well, so are we. Thank you so much, Evie, for talking with us today.
Oh, it's been a true pleasure. Really appreciate it.
The Blessings by Evie Shockley, as well as Rita Dove's Hattie McDaniel, Arrives at the Coconut Grove, can be found on newyorker.com. Rita Dove's most recent book is Playlist for the Apocalypse. Evie Shockley's latest collection is Suddenly We.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Ropeadope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Hannah Eisenman.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.